very brief. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming to this quite important session of this conference, probably the dominant session in the sense that the media and everyone is focused today on this issue of XDR TB. I just wrote an editorial that will appear in the bulletin, in fact, in the International Journal of the Union, and I was talking there about, are we entering the post-antibiotic era with this type of situation? And it may be an exaggeration, but in reality, we are running fast towards development of resistance to more and more drugs. And the importance of this session will be effectively that of outlining the history that is behind all of this, starting with the notion, once again, and we have to repeat that, that this happens where TB control is inadequate. This is not something that comes from the sky. It's man-made. There has been a lot of rumor this year about this epidemic, starting in March when in the MMWR, CDC and ourselves actually published the initial report about this that, in fact, in a way, reported, notified the world about the existence of XDR TB without denominators or without much science behind it, in a way, but certainly the existence of XDR TB in at least 17 countries. And we have the list of the 17 countries, of course. We know where this has appeared. There was later on in the summer the big news about the outbreaks in KwaZulu-Natal that has then steered a number of meetings that you will hear about in Johannesburg, in Geneva, and lately in Pretoria. So you will hear about the country responses, you will hear about the introduction, hopefully, of new diagnostics soon, you will hear the issue related to drug access, and the fact that, in the end, what we need is much more or many more resources than we thought we would have needed this year to face TB, because this is a costly, unfortunately, and a costly mistake, that of allowing XDR TB to grow. With that, I immediately call on Sarita Shah from the Montefiore Medical Center in Bronx, New York, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Yeshiva University, New York, to tell us right away what is XDR-TB, what are the current definitions, the plans for the future, surveillance and reporting. And I apologize, I will have to go out for 10 minutes from this room for a meeting related to this issue, and I will get back in the next 15 or so. Thank you. You have the floor.
This talk was prepared in conjunction with Abigail Wright from the Stop TB department at WHO. Multidrug-resistant tuberculosis is defined as resistance to at least isoniazid and rifampicin and emerged as a major public health issue in the 1990s. MDR-TB is caused by inadequate treatment of drug-susceptible TB or by primary infection with a drug-resistant strain. The treatment of MDR-TB requires use of second-line anti-tuberculosis drugs. Therapy is more expensive, complex, lengthy, and toxic than treatment of regular drug-susceptible TB. Inadequate treatment of MDR-TB will, predictably, result in the emergence of TB strains with resistance to second-line drugs. If a patient with MDR-TB develops resistance to multiple second-line drugs, they may be very difficult, if not impossible in some settings, to treat successfully. In order to understand the definition and implications of XDR-TB, it's important to have a basic understanding of the treatment of MDR-TB. Second-line drugs are divided into six classes, which are shown in the blue boxes on this slide. Examples of drugs in each of the classes are shown to the right of each box. In designing a treatment regimen for a patient with MDR-TB, a minimum of 4 to 6 drugs should be used. The remaining first-line drugs to which the organism is susceptible should be used whenever possible, as these are the most effective and have the least side effects. Then second-line drugs are added, starting with one from the injectable class, a fluoroquinolone, and as many as needed from the last three classes to bring the total to 4 to 6 drugs to which the organism is known or likely to be susceptible. However, these last three drug classes are less potent, and DST for these classes is less reliable than for the other drugs. If a patient is resistant to multiple second-line drugs, such as in this case with the shaded boxes, it is very difficult to design a treatment regimen with enough drugs with proven efficacy against MDR-TB. Earlier this year, the CDC, in collaboration with WHO and the Supranational Reference Laboratory Network, published a report that documented and defined, for the first time, the emergence of tuberculosis strains with resistance to multiple second-line drugs. Extensively drug-resistant TB, or XDR-TB, was originally defined as MDR-TB with further resistance to at least three of the six classes of second-line drugs. The results in the MMWR Global Survey that Mario mentioned use this definition in reporting of results. However, following the reports from KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, which were characterized by very high mortality among a largely HIV co-infected population, there was discussion about revising the original definition. The meeting of the Global XDR-TB Task Force in early October brought together laboratory specialists, clinicians, and epidemiologists. The main factors that were considered in revising the definition were the poor reproducibility of drug susceptibility testing for some second-line drugs, the differing clinical importance of some second-line drugs compared to others, namely that patients with resistance to aminoglycosides and fluoroquinolones have poorer treatment outcomes, and the limited testing for all second-line drugs in most countries. For example, a laboratory may not be equipped to test for drugs that are not available for treatment of patients in that country. Based on these considerations, the revised task force definition of XDR-TB is the occurrence of TB in persons whose isolates are resistant to at least isoniazid and rifampicin, or MDR-TB, plus resistance to any fluoroquinolone and at least one injectable second-line drug, namely amikacin, kanamycin, or capreomycin. I will now present the findings from the Global Survey of Supranational Reference Laboratories reported in the MMWR. One important thing to keep in mind is that the lack of standardized data collection globally for second-line drug susceptibility testing is a major limitation in systematically assessing the global burden and prevalence of XDR-TB at this moment. Nonetheless, prompted by anecdotal reports of second-line drug resistance, we sought to quantify the extent to which resistance to multiple second-line drugs has begun to emerge globally. We conducted a retrospective survey of supranational reference laboratories for M. tuberculosis isolates that had been tested for second-line drug resistance for any reason during 2000 to 2004. The SRLs are a network of mycobacteriology laboratories on six continents, so this provided a global geographic distribution for the survey. However, these isolates were a convenient sample of a referral population, which is more likely to include high-risk patients. Thus, we also looked at population-level data from South Korea, the United States, and Latvia. There were 14 of the 23 eligible supranational reference laboratories that participated in this study and sent data on isolates tested in their laboratory. This map shows the geographic distribution of the countries that are supported by the 14 participating SRLs. There were 49 countries marked here in red that had data included in this study. However, the data we received were sparse from Africa and were not available from India or China. We received data on 17,690 isolates for this study. Of these, 3,520, or 20%, were MDR-TB. A total of 347, or 10%, of MDR-TB isolates were resistant to at least three second-line drug classes and met the original MMWR definition for XDR-TB. Using the revised task force definition, a total of 234 cases would be classified as XDR-TB. Looking at the geographic distribution of the XDR-TB cases from this survey, the highest number and proportion among MDR-TB cases were seen in South Korea, Latvia, and the countries of the former Soviet Union. Again, this survey does not allow us to draw conclusions about the true global burden or prevalence of XDR-TB, but does tell us that XDR-TB is present in all regions of the world. In order to determine estimates of burden and prevalence of XDR-TB, standardized surveillance and reporting of drug resistance is needed. Looking at existing systems, historically, drug resistance data were not reported in a standardized way, making it difficult to compare rates between countries and estimate global burden. In response, in 1994, the WHO IUATLD Global Project on anti-tuberculosis drug resistance was begun. To date, the Global Project has collected data from nearly 90 countries and many subnational settings within countries on first-line drug resistance. Approximately half of the countries reporting are conducting continuous surveillance or culture and first-line DST as part of routine diagnosis of TB cases. The other half of these countries conduct periodic surveys in order to estimate drug resistance. In addition, since 2005, WHO has requested annual reporting of the number of DSTs and the number of lab-confirmed MDR-TB cases reported. But because of the unavailability of testing and treatment in most countries, the cases reported are small and generally not a good way of estimating prevalence of drug resistance. As testing and treatment programs scale up, this will be a more useful indicator in the future. Because so few countries are routinely offering first-line DST, second-line drug testing is even less accessible in most countries. Though challenging, second-line resistance among MDR cases can and is starting to be evaluated in a standardized manner. Currently, the Global Project recommends that all MDR-TB cases detected in surveys are confirmed at SRLs and further tested for resistance to selected second-line drugs. Many countries conducting routine culture and first-line DST in all TB cases also test for second-line drugs. Second-line drug resistance among MDR-TB cases can be collected from many of these countries. It's important to note, however, that an international quality assurance system for second-line DST is still under development. In place, it is difficult to get laboratory results, especially for some second-line drugs which are known to have less reproducible results. These existing surveillance systems that I've just described can be enhanced by focusing attention on risk groups, by use of new rapid testing tools, and by incorporating HIV testing. Currently, WHO is recommending first-line and second-line DST on known MDR or failure cases to better understand the profile of second-line drug resistance in the highest risk groups. In many countries, testing will be facilitated by a supranational reference laboratory. This information can be used to establish the presence of XDR-TB in high-risk populations and will provide guidance for developing treatment regimens. Use of rapid testing, referring to all kinds, is being explored for both diagnostic and screening purposes, but also to facilitate rapid baseline surveys of XDR-TB in selected populations. It is expected that such surveys, carried out by an external reference laboratory, will be particularly useful while laboratory networks are being scaled up. There's now movement towards integrating HIV testing into routine drug resistance surveys, and data are beginning to emerge as access to HIV testing increases. HIV testing should also be integrated into rapid surveys of risk groups and sentinel systems where possible. As treatment for HIV becomes more widely available, HIV testing will surely expand. There are several important implications of the emergence of XDR-TB. First, adequate diagnosis and treatment of drug-susceptible TB remains the most assured way of preventing TB drug resistance. For this reason, it is critical to scale up and improve the quality of TB and MDR-TB diagnosis and treatment programs. International standards for second-line drug testing have not been established, but are urgently needed. In addition, as will be discussed shortly, the reproducibility of DST for some drugs is poor, and better, more reliable methods are needed. Lastly, we must remember that these are people. These are mothers, husbands, teachers, and nurses who are afflicted with virtually untreatable TB. We must increase access to modern diagnostic tools and second-line drugs for all patients with MDR and XDR-TB to have a fighting chance of being cured of their illness. The importance of developing new diagnostic and new drugs is now more important than ever. All TB patients of all ages have the right to receive the highest quality care. Thank you.
Thank you. In the interest of time, I request that those of you with questions, jot them down, write them down. We will have some time for group questions and answers. Our next presenter is Dr. Karen Veyer, who is director of the Unit for Tuberculosis Research and in the South African Medical Research Council. Karen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ken. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I've been asked to give you a very brief overview of challenges with second-line drug susceptibility testing, the need for scaling up laboratory networks, and an overview of rapid diagnostics that are currently in the pipeline. It's been said over and over that laboratory services really represent the weak link in the chain of TB control, and this link, this weakness, is now accentuated within the context of XDR-TB, and the issues are summarized, and I want to focus your attention on point three, that when we talk about XDR-TB, we need to about biosafety in laboratories and safety of lab workers. The WHO estimates with our current laboratory capacity that of the just over 4,000 cases of MDR-TB existing annually, only about 5% are being detected because of the problems related to DST. Trying to scale up laboratories is complicated, and this slide shows you what's happened in the National Health Laboratory Services in South Africa over time. It's the same laboratory over three decades. The WHO global plan shows that expansion of laboratory services would have to be almost exponential to reach the 2015 targets, and needs to happen very rapidly. Sarita mentioned the network of 25 supranational reference labs. These labs link 120 countries, but you can see the absence of labs in the regions where they are most needed, particularly within the context of M and XDR-TB. Also important to keep in mind that scaling up laboratory services require much more than just transfer of modern technologies. And these three pictures come from my country. So the fact that South Africa is fairly far advanced in terms of laboratory capacity doesn't mean that we don't have problems of infrastructure and transport. In trying to scale up laboratory systems, it's therefore very important that these factors be taken into account. Sarita pointed to the new WHO protocols for screening high-risk patients. One needs to be sure that those specimens reach the laboratory quickly. Laboratory infrastructure needs to be developed, and I'm not only talking about the laboratories per se, it's the electrical power supply, water supply, everything else that goes with that, and there needs to be a proper plan of maintenance. Staff need to be specifically trained on DST and culture techniques, and we have a huge problem with retaining capable laboratory staff, especially in developing countries. Goes without saying that we need appropriate quality assurance and quality control programs. We also need a system of rapid transfer of information once the results are available, and it doesn't make much sense trying to accelerate the diagnosis of cases if we can't also provide adequate treatment for these cases. Turning to some of the challenges that we face with second-line drug susceptibility testing, if we take one step back and look at conventional first-line drug susceptibility testing methods, we have methods in solid medium where we define resistance based on a critical proportion of growth of a culture when exposed to drugs in that medium, and there are different methods as outlined there. Newer technology make use of liquid medium where we test for the presence of growth in the presence of a particular drug, and these are largely automated systems. For the first line drugs, those four listed there, the methodology is well standardized, well described, and it doesn't really matter which method is used, the results are highly reliable and consistent, and the predictive values of the first-line drug susceptibility testing procedures have been well described, although it's important to note that these values vary depending on the prevalence of resistance. When we come to second-line drug susceptibility testing, the picture is somewhat different. We have reliable, reproducible methods only for the aminoglycoside polypeptide group of drugs and for the fluoroquinolones. For the aminoglycosides and polypeptides, there are issues of cross-resistance between the individual drugs in those groups, and these are complex interactions. With fluoroquinolones, the cross-resistance is complete, so one can reliably test for one fluoroquinolone and extrapolate resistance to the others. However, for the classes of drugs at the bottom, we have no reliable drug susceptibility test. Currently, our constraints in trying to do second-line drug susceptibility testing rest with the fact that we need cultures to be able to determine the drug resistance profile, and therefore the diagnosis is always late. It's complex, as I've said, and part of the reason relates to the fact that the drug powders that we use are really unstable in the drug susceptibility testing process. Another major constraint is that the concentration at which we define resistance is often very close or similar to the serum level attained in the blood or to the drug MIC, and as a result, one gets inconsistency with different tests of the same organism. Talked about the issue of cross-resistance and the fact that for the second-line drugs, the methodology has not been standardized. We have very little information to link a resistant result in the lab to the clinical progress of a patient. And as Sarita has pointed out, very few laboratories do have the technical capacity. So what is it that we need? Well, we need a drug susceptibility test that has these six characteristics. And unfortunately, there is not a test available on the market today that meets all of these. But there are some promising tests, and I'll just very briefly go through them. This slide depicts the absorption of new technology, and as we expect, it's largely quick absorption in the developed countries where financial and other resources are available. But there's a growing demand for more expensive, more sophisticated tests to also become available in developing countries. Some of the new culture-based technologies in liquid culture is now the standard of care in developed countries. They are unfortunately still expensive, fairly sophisticated, and only in two studies have there been some selective validation of some of the drugs in proper studies. There are some direct tests that are being done on sputum samples largely. The problem with these tests is that they have not yet been systematically evaluated. And in especially low-volume laboratories where there's a tendency to batch the specimens, there's an unfortunate delay in reporting the results of rapid tests. Molecular methods that we have available all show good performance characteristics, sensitivity approaching that of culture, but they are still very expensive and in most instances require sophisticated technology, although the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics are working with manufacturers to try to identify suitable platforms for use in developing countries. And the aim of FIND is to find ultimately a point of care test that is robust, affordable, but there's also a recognition that some of these sophisticated tests would have of necessity only be used at centralized level. This slide from Rick O'Brien shows the deliverables up until 2010, and within the context of XDR-TB, I think it's very important that these timelines be shifted up. We can't wait to another 10 years. brief overview of some of the technologies that FIND will be investigating. The first is a fast plaque assay, which rapidly tests for rifampicin resistance in smear-positive sputum specimens, results available in 2 days. This is the principles. The cultures are being treated with rifampicin. The cells are then infected with phages, and once the phages are killed, the uptake of rifampicin can be measured. If the strain is susceptible, TB bacilli are killed, and therefore there would be no observation of phages. And this is typically what one sees in the laboratory. Resistant strain, no difference between cultures treated with rifampicin, and a susceptible strain, clear difference. Second test that has been extensively used in Latvia is the InnoLipa test from Immunogenetics, which is a molecular line probe assay. It tests for five types of susceptible genotypes and 4 types of rifampicin resistant phenotypes, and it's potentially a point of care test, but unfortunately still very expensive. FIND has recently evaluated the fast plaque and the InnoLipa test in a trial in Peru, comparing as gold standard the indirect DST on LJ. And the purpose of this slide is just to point out that the negative predictive values of all 4 of these tests are really promising, meaning we can quickly screen out MDR-TB. Another test that has recently been introduced is the HAIN genotype MTBDR line probe assay, again a strip test, which detects or diagnoses in tuberculosis and then probes for the genes that select INH resistance as well as the gene for rifampicin resistance, so one could have a rapid diagnosis of MDR very quickly. Small study recently reported evaluated this test directly on sputum specimens and in a few samples showed high concordance between the different tests evaluated. The Gene Expert system is another system that could potentially provide a result within a few hours. Unfortunately, again, still expensive, still under development. And then the fourth test is a microscopic test where one makes use of the principles that tuberculosis organisms grow rapidly in liquid culture and that they form characteristic cords that can be observed microscopically. This paper again shows very promising performance characteristics of that test. This is what it looks like under the microscope, typical cord formation where there's resistance and less so when there's susceptibility. I think one cannot talk about new tools for diagnosis of XDR-TB without talking about the need to molecularly characterize these strains. We need to look at where outbreaks are occurring and which strains are responsible. This is my second last slide. I'm just going to quickly go through the recommendations from the Global TB Task Force in Geneva, where the need for laboratory capacity strengthening was again highlighted as a prerequisite for mounting an appropriate response to XDR-TB. There's an absolutely urgent need for lab capacity strengthening to be expanded, to be adequately funded, and to be accelerated. We very quickly need to look at the role of rapid rifampicin tests as surrogate markers for M and XDR-TB and how they would fit into diagnostic algorithms. And the SRL network needs to be expanded if we have to provide the support to the surveys and surveillance programs that are coming. In terms of research needs, there's an urgent need to standardize second-line drug susceptibility testing to be sure that what we see in the laboratory actually corresponds with the patient's clinical response. To look more closely at some of the second-line drugs like fluoroquinolones in direct testing on sputum, We need very quickly large-scale demonstration projects to evaluate the role of rifampicin tests and to look at the inclusion of fluoroquinolones in some of the more novel tests like the fast flock and the strip tests. And then to add to the previous speaker's call, we urgently need new diagnostics, especially for smear-negative cases of M and XDR-TB, which is increasingly becoming prevalent in high HIV burden settings. Thank you.
Is at the State Center of TB and Lung Diseases in Riga, Latvia, as well as a WHO collaborating center for the training on MDR-TB. Vaira, you have the floor.
Thank you. Dear chairpersons, dear colleagues, I will present you management and treatment of XDR-TB in Latvia. Latvia is one of the Baltic states consistently ranked among countries with highest rates of MDR-TB worldwide and implemented DOTS countrywide in 1996 and MDR-TB management started in 1997. Latvia has very rapid increase in tuberculosis incidence and MDR-TB incidence. We speak in 1998 and later decrease. Our numbers of registered cases decreased 2.2 times over these years. Among old cases, treatment cases, MDR-TB decreased 4 times during these years. Registered numbers among HIV patients, TB HIV patients increased, total number and as well MDR-TB HIV cases. However, it's not big numbers, it's increasing. Laboratory diagnostic methods used for the susceptibility testing basically is Levenstein-Jensen method by absolute concentration, but we use very widely BACTEC midget system according priorities to use this test. And first priority is patients with high risk of MDR-TB. The second priority is all sputum smear positive cases for better earlier detection of MDR-TB and infection control purposes. Inolipa test is used for high-risk MDR-TB patients for more earlier detection of multidrug resistance and start proper treatment. We use drug susceptibility tests for all second-line drugs we use for treatment for MDR-TB patients. Don't use for clarithromycin amoxiclav because we don't have this test. Objectives of our studies is determination of proportion of extensively resistant patients according to patterns of resistance, number of XDR-TB patients according WHO definition and previous definition, and by patients' categories over the time, determination of treatment outcome by patterns of extensive resistance, and determination of HIV seroprevalence rates by patterns of extensive resistance. We used for this analysis registration cohort for 2000-2005 and treatment cohorts for 2000-2003. All these data is entered in MDR-TB database And we analyzed this data from this database and the treatment outcome for these 3 years. Definitions, MDR-TB, it's resistance at least to INH and rifampicin. XDR-TB, we used revised WHO definition, task for definition accepted now. It's MDR-TB resistance plus fluoroquinolones and one of injectable. And the previous definition published in March, MDR-TB resistance plus 3 second line drugs out of 6 classes. Proportion of extensively drug resistance according drug these two XDR-TB definitions, you can see on this table. The first definition is increasing over the years, starting from 11% in 2000 and increasing up to 30% in 2005. But if you look on new definition accepted by task force, it's lower number of cases and starting from 2.5% increasing to 7%. If we look in which patients groups is mostly distributed this extensive drug resistance, you can see then among patients who previously was treated with second-line drugs is more rapid increase in this number of patients and most distributed in this group. But among new patients never treated, it's also increasing as well among patients who was treated only with first-line drugs before. Resistance patterns to individual drugs among these 820 patients we have registered in database, you can see that the resistance to first-line drugs is very high at Ambutol 75, 70% pyrazinamide, streptomycin 97%, kanamycin as well is close to 50%, capremycin 39%. Ofloxacin 9%, protinid 30% as well PAS, and lowest is cyclosurin 2%. Treatment characteristics for all patients who was treated for MDR-TB during this year 2000 cohort, which was published in Lancet, we had 204 patients with 107 distinct treatment regimen. That means that this management of these patients with extensive resistance to second-line drugs is very, very difficult. And the median drugs used for this treatment, 6, and most common used drugs was ofloxacin, protinamide, thiacetazone, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol. treatment outcomes by drug resistance patterns by shows us that MDR-TB had treatment outcome cure plus completion 67%, and it's decreasing according to definitions. The old definition MDR-TB plus three second line drugs achieve cure rate for 58%. But for new definitions, it's decreased very much. It's cure rate only for 28% of patients, and failure rate increased to 55% of patients. HIV rates among drug MDR-TB patients group shows that for overall MDR-TB patient groups, there is 3%. We don't have high rates of HIV among MDR-TB patients up to now. But for these subgroups, this percent of these patients increasing. And the highest is among patients which fits for the new definition. In conclusion, acquired MDR-TB is decreasing in Latvia, but still not decreasing primary or primary MDR-TB. XDR-TB is increasing steadily among all MDR-TB categories, but particularly in patients who have a history of previous treatment with second-line drugs. Cure rates decrease significantly when the patterns of drug resistance includes injectable aminoglycosides and fluoroquinolones. But it should be studied more and find out to how many drugs these patients have resistance. HIV may be a factor in worse treatment outcomes in drug-resistant patients, and discrepant laboratory tests to second-line drugs sometimes makes the management of MDR-TB patients difficult. Challenges in controlling drug-resistant in tuberculosis in Latvia. First is improving treatment outcomes for drug-sensitive case and not allow develop new cases with MDR-TB. Rapid drug-resistant detection, appropriate treatment, rapid diagnostic tools for all infectious cases, expand use of contact investigation, decrease treatment interruption and default, improving patient compliance and, if necessary, use compulsory treatment for this patient. Infection control measures should be strengthening and separation of patients with risk for extensive drug resistance should be sought more strongly healthcare setting in prisons. Isolation for patients on palliative care, which can't achieve cure, it's a difficult issue and can be solved. And new drugs and treatment regimen is necessary for these patients with extensive drug resistance, which can't achieve cure. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Vaira. I'll remind the audience that we will have questions and answers at the end of the presentations. I invite Dr. Paul Nunn, who is the coordinator of the WHO team and STOP-TB department concerned with TB and HIV, as well as tuberculosis drug resistance, to join us and present on the global emergency response. Paul, the floor is yours.
Right. Well, let me start by thanking Ken and the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. So I'm going to focus on the global level and the emergency aspect of the response to XDR-TB. And I speak on behalf of a lot of people involved in this process. I will discuss what has been, what's taken place up till now, what have we already done, what the framework is under which we are planning the work forward, and what actions more specifically are planned. On the actions to date, I hesitate because this isn't the last version of the presentation, but never mind. It's one of these PowerPoint moments. You will have heard, many of you will be aware of the meeting in Atlanta in May, which took place under the partners rubric, and was also the working group meeting of the MDR working group, at which we first heard about the problems in Tugela Ferry. The WHO Strategic Technical Advisory Group took up the issue in June and made it very clear that they were expecting a swift response to the problem being addressed. The Tugela Ferry information was presented at the IAS conference in Toronto and picked up by a few major newspapers. And we then moved quite quickly, the South African Medical Research Council and the Centers for Disease Control with WHO, to have an expert consultation in Johannesburg on September 7th and 8th. In preparation for that meeting, WHO issued a note to the media expressing concern about the situation, and the response to that note for the media I'll discuss in a moment. The following Friday, September the 15th, we got the go-ahead to form a response team after discussions with the teams involved in WHO in the SARS and avian flu and Ebola work. The following Monday, September the 18th, the response team was formed. Within a few days, quite quickly, although not quickly enough for some, we had basic information on the website, both StopTB and WHO. We had frequently asked questions prepared. We had a paper for the weekly epidemiological record ready, and we were already embarking on fundraising, of which more later. By October 9th, 10th, we had a meeting prepared for of the first meeting of the global XDR, excuse me, of the global XDR task force. The day after, we had the revised definition that you've just heard about on the website and a meeting report prepared for the weekly epidemiological record, but some of you will have seen, I think it was last week, the new definitions already in the weekly epidemiological record. The South African Department of Health asked us in WHO to take part in a consultation with the SADC countries, of which seven were able to make it, on October the 17th and 18th. This is some headlines taken from the rather unprecedented media response in preparation for the September meeting, and you will, if you just cast your eye over some of these headlines, notice the problem in getting out accurate messages. Now, I'd like to present the framework under which the global level response is being organized, and the first and the most important priority, I think, is the immediate strengthening of the essentials of TB and HIV prevention, care, and control in countries. And I'll go into all of these in a bit more detail in a moment. Secondly, strengthening the management of M and XDR TB, and particularly, this is both case management and programmatic management, and the introduction of new rapid diagnostic tests. There must be an intensified effort to build laboratory capacity in addition to existing efforts. Infection control is paramount, together with protection of healthcare workers, especially in high HIV settings. Surveillance and monitoring of M and XDR TB is essential if we're to understand how far and to what extent we have a problem, but it needs to be incorporated into more long-term surveillance methodology as quickly as possible. We need clear advocacy, good communications, and mobilization of societies. Research and development of new tools needs to be accelerated, and in order to pay for all this, we need urgent resource mobilization. So to take the i.e. basic TB control, as well as the more resistance-related issues in this second area here, which I will come to in a moment. South Africa and Lesotho have officially requested WHO assistance, and there are discussions ongoing with many of the other Southern African countries. And in particular, South Africa has requested assistance with some human resource issues, with the cross-border migration of XDR cases, particularly those in the mines returning home, possibly to foreign countries for the holiday period. There needs to be a significant increase in both international and national TB staff addressing the basics as well as the drug-resistant issues, and an urgent increase in training courses for drug resistance management. We held the first training course in the African region in October in Dar es Salaam, but we're moving very quickly to organize a second course. And there will be immediate revision of the global plan to stop TB, to reflect the need to incorporate XDR-TV, increase the budget, and increase the speed of scale-up, amongst other things. And that work has already begun. The management of MDR-TV and XDR-TV, both case management and program management, clearly needs to be strengthened. There will be addenda, there are being addenda produced to the guidelines for the programmatic management of drug-resistant TB that came out in May in order to reflect the issues of XDR and make it very clear that XDR is included in that, in those guidelines. The algorithm for identification and management of suspects is being revised and will shortly be disseminated, and WHO and CDC staff are both very much involved in these two issues. Access to rapid tests for both rifampicin and INH resistance needs to be achieved, and as you've heard, there will be a meeting conducted by FIND and the South African Medical Research Council on November the 16th to address this in the Southern African region. And enlargement of the Green Light Committee is already underway in order to expand access to second-line drugs. And I think it's important to mention here that the Global Fund has already agreed to undertake procedures which will facilitate access to second-line drugs for countries and to support the Green Light Committee's work. And UNITAID, the French pursued with partners, approach to use airline tax funding for AIDS, TB, and malaria have agreed to support the provision, the procurement of second-line drugs, as well as the acceleration of the pre-qualification of manufacturers for second-line drugs, and they've made an agreement with the WHO Essential Drugs Program to do this just recently. So this is a major step forward, I think. And WHO is undertaking to disseminate the legal and ethical global guidelines that address the compulsory issues surrounding medical treatment and isolation. Karen has discussed intensified laboratory capacity building in some detail, so I will emphasize just a couple of things here. The need for a national budgeted plan for accelerated laboratory capacity. You'll notice in this table here that if you just look at the high burden countries in Africa, excluding South Africa, population of nearly 400 million, there are just 13 laboratories capable of doing culture, and 11 of these can do drug susceptibility testing. South Africa, with a population of 47 million, exceeds this capacity on its own. And if you look at the non-high burden countries, the number of laboratories capable of carrying out reliable culture, I think, can be counted on the fingers of one hand. So we have a problem with laboratory capacity. And yet, ultimately, our goal needs to be, I think, access to timely, quality-assured TB lab services, including rapid acid-fast bacillus culture and DST for all patients, which is a difficult goal in this context. Infection control. The infection control guidelines prepared in 1999 are being updated, thanks to CDC and Paul Jensen particularly. We've recently prepared an addendum to those guidelines to address the issues of infection control in high HIV settings. These are ready and they are being prepared for publication electronically and in hard copy. And rapid implementation of these infection control measures needs to be put into place immediately in healthcare settings and other risk areas, including prisons. A working group on infection control is being established within the StopTB partnership, and members of my team have organized a first meeting of people interested in joining this working group, which will take place this afternoon at, I think, 4 o'clock. But somebody will correct me if I'm wrong in the discussion period. And I think this group needs to address particularly an urgent implementation plan of the infection control guidelines at country level. In surveillance, there's a lot of things that could be said, but to simplify it, I think we need rapid, simple tests to determine the geographical distribution and the size of XDR-TB. We have a generic protocol ready, which will also link this XDR work with HIV, which is fundamentally important. At least some of these surveys, I hope, will look at the genetic strains. and at least some of them also will be linked with rapid rifampicin testing. But I think we need also to have to look at the detailed epidemiology of a number of cases to determine more precisely how these cases arise. And the South African government has agreed that this shall be done in South Africa. Advocacy, communication, social mobilization is fundamental. A task force has been established, and they are addressing the priorities, the strategy, and the funding for increasing capacity and strengthening communications at all levels. They will address the development and dissemination of messages on XDR-TB following the guidelines, if you like, discussed at the Global Task Force meeting, and they are planning media events both globally and nationally to get out the messages. On new tools, WHO and the research working groups are organizing a meeting on the research implications of XDR-TB in early 2007, probably in Cape Town, and the Minister of Health is being invited. Now, all this costs money. Now, these numbers may be a little bit too small to see, but they focus on the financial requirements from now until the end of 2007 in the Southern African countries. And we calculate somewhat crudely the country costs as being around about $80 million US, with $35 million going to all the activities that we have already presented, about $40 million for the cost of second-line anti-TB drugs to some 6,000 M and XDR-TB patients, and $5 million for rapid diagnostic tests. The international agencies require about $50 million to support this and provide the technical assistance required. Now, this is effectively the summary of a more detailed plan that we have ready and that will be disseminated to potential donors next week. At the most recent consultation in South Africa in Pretoria, these countries that were present in this list here have also agreed to provide plans, national level plans, with costing by, I think it was the 10th of November. So we hope that they will appear. If not, we'll provide the technical assistance to get them pretty soon thereafter. There needs to be briefing of the development partners and agencies, i.e. potential donors, on the topic of the plan, and that work has already begun, and that's why your chairman skipped out and came back a moment ago. The Global Fund is open to reprogramming of existing grants to incorporate XDR activities, and of course they're very interested in receiving applications in round 7, which we hope will take place next year. The PEPFAR country operational plans for 2007 are virtually a done deal, but there are in a number of countries, I think, still possibilities of incorporating XDR-TB activities, and therefore that opportunity, where it exists, should be seized. And USAID have said that the TB CAP system can be used to support XDR-TB, but this, of course, requires that countries request that it be done. So the next steps with respect to global coordination, there will be meetings between WHO and the South African Department of Health over around about November 15-16, and I will be going down to have further discussions with the department. And that occurs around the time of the workshop on rapid testing in Pretoria also. South Africa has agreed to bring up the issue of XDR-TB at the Southern African Development Community Health Ministers meeting, which I think is on November 17th in Namibia. The coordinating board of the Stop-TB partnership will address XDR-TB in Jakarta in 4 weeks' time or so, and will consider, amongst other things, the importance of strengthening links between all the working groups and the MDR-TB working group in order to develop the responses we've been talking about on XDR-TB, and in particular, revising the global plan. And we would anticipate that country-level implementation should be underway in the worst-affected Southern African countries by December of this year. Now, it's impossible to present in detail an emergency response in 15 minutes, So here are some issues that I must mention or they will otherwise be forgotten. In terms of getting support for activities in countries, countries need to request that support. Secondly, partnerships are essential. Partnerships with other groups, the HIV community, the community themselves affected by TB and HIV. The TB-HIV link is absolutely essential if we're to decrease the mortality in the HIV infected. But I think here we still need better to define the products that are going to be created between as a result of TB and HIV collaboration. The people working on human resources for health must be involved in this process. It's crucial. And the economic analysis of the impact of TB and TB control being prepared for the African Ministerial Conference, which keeps being postponed, needs now to incorporate issues of XDR-TB. So this presentation is focused on the Southern African context, but of course there are already MDR efforts underway in China, India and Russia, and we need urgently to incorporate the XDR component into those efforts. So I will finish by quoting The Lancet, that if we fail to act now to contain the threat posed by XDR-TB, it will have devastating consequences for patients with TB, particularly those co-infected with HIV/AIDS. So I sincerely hope that the plan that I've laid out will rapidly be funded. And for those of you who may be responsible, we need $5 million by the end of this year in order to keep existing efforts rolling. Thank you very much.
So since we are, thank you very much, Paul, since we are in an emergency mode, let's proceed, and very rapidly. I introduce now Mrs. Elisabeth Hoff, who is the Chief of Operations of the newly established Interim Secretariat for UNITAID, that is based at the moment at WHO in Geneva. Elisabeth, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting UNITAID here to this conference. And I'm very pleased to inform you that we are now moving ahead to support multi-drug resistance TB. And I would just like to bring you back to inform you what UNITAID is. It is actually an international drug purchase facility, which is popularly called UNITAID. And there were five funding countries. It was actually the Minister of Foreign Affairs in France, Dr. Douste-Blassy, who took the initiative to establish this, and he was quickly joined by Chile, Brazil, Norway, and United Kingdom. And the idea is that this is going to provide sustainable and predictable financing. France introduced the airline tax, and we have seen from the media that more than 96% of the French population is now supporting this solidarity fund. Norway has introduced a tax on the emission on CO2, and the other countries are also providing funding which is predictable and sustainable through long-term budgetary contributions. And it is moving ahead at the G8 summit in St. Petersburg this year. 19 countries actually expressed an interest in joining UNITAID. And UNITAID has declared that they are going to support treatment for TB, malaria, and HIV. And this they're going to do by actually reducing the quality prices on quality drugs and accelerating the pace at which they will become available to the people who need them. And there are three quite clear approaches that will be followed. They will work through partnerships, and the partners have been identified. For HIV, we are working closely with UNAIDS, with the Clinton Initiative, and also for TB, it's the Global Drug Facility and the Green Light Committee in WHO. And for malaria, ACT is UNICEF and the Global Fund. As I said, that for UNITAID's mission, it is quite clearly that lowering prices for drugs and diagnostics is a key issue. And when the proposals have come in from the partners, it hasn't been sufficient just to say that we can provide treatment to the people and the number of treatment. They had also had to describe the process that they will go through in order to lower the prices of the drugs and their diagnostics. And this will be done through stronger negotiations through pooled procurement. There will be sort of a cost-plus methodology, and with increased demand, you know, and increased volumes, and there will be increased competition. And all countries should have access to favorable prices that have been obtained by UNITAID. And clearly, we are targeting the poor countries, so 85% of the funding should be going to low-income countries. For TB, the support will be for MDR programs in 2006, $7.9 million US dollars, which will be made available in the beginning of December. And for 2007, there will be $38.2 million available. This might even increase for 2007. We are also supporting pediatric TB by making available appropriate strength TB drugs. And for this year, it will be 0.9 million, which will be increased to around 5 million next year. We work closely with all our partners in setting up these programs. UNITAID will not implement. It will just be a very lean secretariat established at WHO, which will be working with partners. We will work very closely now to try to identify the gaps, the funding gaps for drugs and diagnostics, and hope to come very strongly on the arena at the end of 2006 and to also be working more closely with you in 2007. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This is most welcome news. And now let's have those that are suffering the real burden of XDR, MDR, and of TB, the patients and the community representatives. So we want to hear their perspective. And I have here three colleagues and people that will be talking, starting with Case Gordon, director and founder of the World Care Council, coordinator also of the patient charter that I'm sure he will be talking about, I already see it there, and an acting board member of UNITAID. Later, there will be Mrs. Carol Nirenda, president of World Care Council based in Lusaka, Zambia, TB-HIV activist and also an alternate board member of UNITAID with Case Gordon. And finally, Mr. Maxime Lungam-Sumbu, who is the president of the Club des Amis d'Amiens, a patient TB patient advocacy organization based in Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo, former MDR TB patient and also member of the World Care Council. Thank you very much, Case.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Mario, for allowing us here. I'm actually here not to talk about my experience and my recent upgrade from being an MDR survivor to now an XDR survivor. I'm also not here to talk about the patient's charter, its rights and responsibilities, nor to address the human rights question about MDR and XDR. I am here actually to applaud over the last few months a movement from here, from the people up here and many of you, to begin to gear up, to begin to address an issue that I've been well aware for about 5 years has been hidden in the shadows, many of my peers dying slowly, horribly, and nobody really wanting to talk about it. Over the last 5-6 months since Atlanta, actually, it has given me a breath of fresh air. But it is only the beginning. We need to scale up, gear up, move up a lot faster, and address all of the questions, and as have been outlined already. We'll come back to that. But anyway, one of the things I'm also here to speak about shortly, and I'll then pass the mic to my friends, is that our need as the community to not only get involved, but to lead and to drive the resource mobilization that is needed. Resource financial, but also social mobilization. Right now, over the last few months, we keep hearing about XDR and MDR. Quite a few of my colleagues and peers and friends were afraid. They don't know what this is. They don't know what they should do. Should they bother continuing to take their treatment if it serves no purpose? We need to mobilize our communities with you, the professionals and the experts, to basically pull out a lot of resources to address, as is being outlined by Paul and others. One of our first actions in this mobilization will be in support of UnitAid. I got involved with UnitAid about a year ago because I thought it was a lovely idea. You folks get on airplanes, we get drugs. Good idea. Innovation. From that, we've been working, the communities have been working to figure out how we can use UnitAid and how we can push UnitAid to get bigger and bigger. More money, the more you fly, the more drugs for us. And not just drugs. We're now talking with UnitAid about, oh, we need diagnostics. We will ultimately need new drugs. What can we do about it? There's a limited number of countries involved at present in UnitAid. We intend to push that a lot more countries, not just the donor nations. Every country in the world has a class of people who get on planes. We would appreciate their assistance that when they get on a plane, some of their money ends up buying drugs and driving down the prices of what drugs there are already. Now I will pass the mic to a few people who live in communities that are living in fear today. The more we talk about XDR, the more they're afraid. This is Carol.
Good afternoon, everybody. From several sessions that we have been a part of since we were here, including this one, we have heard over and over again the gravity of MDR-TB and now the emergence of XDR-TB in South Africa and other parts of the world. We people living with the disease are happy that there is this press session today that has been organized to begin to address this problem. At present, very few people have access to second-line drugs or to the good MDR treatment generally. One without the other serves no purpose. We have no idea how many people in the world today die of MDR-TB or XDR-TB. This is an enormous problem that threatens the whole entire global efforts for stopping TB. We need together to advocate for second-line drugs now and new drugs at long term. We also need laboratories that can do drug sensitivity testing to know if one is resistant to the drugs. In the South, only South Africa has that kind of a laboratory. We have heard about the new initiative, namely UnitAid. We, the communities of people living with the disease, have also developed an innovative campaign under the banner, You Fly, We Live. My colleague Maxime will expand more on this system of resource mobilization. Thank you. Maxime.
Excuse us, we thought there was going to be bilingual translation from French into English, but apparently it's not working. I know there's a doctor in the house. Is there somebody who can translate in the house who can quickly... Elizabeth?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Mario, can you give us a bit of a hand?
Good English.
Okay. Sure.
Okay.
Allez-y.
Merci.
Thank you.
Pour un problème extrême, une solution extrême aussi.
For a serious problem, a serious solution.
Vous pouvez imaginer un instant le nombre de personnes souffrant de la multirésistance qui ne sont pas diagnostiquées et n'ont pas accès au traitement à travers le monde.
Imagine the number of people with drug-resistant tuberculosis not diagnosed, not treated across the world.
L'exemple de mon pays, la République démocratique du Congo.
My country, the DRC.
Les multirésistants sont traités seulement dans la capitale, à Kinshasa.
Drug resistance is known about only in Kinshasa.
Et alors, le reste des provinces, quel est l'essor de tous ces multirésistants qui sont là.
So what happens to multi-resistant patients in the rest of the country?
En 1998, le taux de multirésistants pour les nouveaux cas de TP1 plus était de 2,1% et pour les cas de retraités était de 22,3%.
In 1998, primary resistance had a prevalence of 2.1 and secondary resistance over 20%.
Et qu'en est-il aujourd'hui?
And what about today?
Il est très important que tous les acteurs dans la lutte contre la tuberculose soutiennent cette initiative.
It's extremely important that everybody involved with tuberculosis control supports this initiative.
Je vais vous dire une chose. Quand moi, par exemple, je suis devant un malade tuberculé comme moi, parce que j'en étais en 2000.
Let me share with you some thoughts. When I'm facing a patient with tuberculosis, and I had TB myself,
et que je lui ai dit que la tuberculose est curable et guérissable, et qu'il lui arrive un temps où on lui dit qu'il est multirésistant et qu'il doit débourser de l'argent pour savoir s'il va guérir. Alors celui-là risque de croire que la tuberculose n'est pas curable.
Initially, such a patient is told, well, this is a curable and treatable disease, and then later he has to be told, well, now you're going to have to spend money to buy additional drugs for MDR. And that person believes then this is no longer a treatable disease.
Nous, les patients tuberculés, soutenons avec notre dernière énergie cette initiative.
So with all of our energy, we will support this initiative.
Voilà pourquoi nous profitons de cette occasion à la 37e conférence de l'Union, dans cette session spéciale de la multirésistance de la tuberculose, pour lancer l'initiative You Fly, I Live.
So therefore, I'm extremely pleased to be able to assist at the launch of this initiative, You Fly, I Live, at this, the 37th meeting of the International Union, at the special session on MDR and XDR.
Nous voulons seulement dire, quand tu prends un avion, moi j'ai la vie.
So I just want to say, we just want to say, when you take a plane, we have life.
Donc nous vous demandons aussi à plaider pour que tous vos pays emboîtent les pas aux 5 pays d'unité.
So please, we plead with you, ask your countries to join this initiative supported by 5 countries.
Afin que la taxe sur les billets d'avion soit applicable partout.
And let the airline tax be applicable everywhere.
Et pour que tout patient tuberculé, où qu'il soit, ait l'accès au diagnostic et au traitement.
The TB patients everywhere may have access to diagnostics and treatment.
You fly, I live, and thank you.
Thank you, Maxime. The last presentation, or last set of remarks, come from Dr. Kevin DeKalk, who, in addition to being an impromptu interpreter, happens to be the director of the WHO HIV-AIDS department. And he will talk from the perspective of the HIV program.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you, Mario, colleagues, friends. I just want to make some very general comments from the perspective of the public health community on the HIV, from the HIV perspective. Firstly, I want to congratulate the TB community, which has changed so much over the past 10 years since I first attended this meeting. I'm struck by the advocacy, the successful advocacy that's going on. On the other hand, I also find some concern in the fact that this is driven, as we've witnessed by the our friends who've spoken, it's driven by the issues of multidrug resistance, or XDR. It's driven by HIV infection, and yet the majority of those 2 million or so who die annually of tuberculosis actually have susceptible TB. And it's susceptible TB that is at the very problem of this issue, these issues that we're talking about, of HIV-associated TB and XDR. I'm impressed also at the emphasis that's being put, again at this meeting, on the need for new tools. The comment that actually we're using technology, some of which was developed in the late 19th century, and yet that mantra I remember first hearing in the late 1980s, and I think is actually Dr. Jim Mason, the then director of the Centers for Disease Control, who actually said it at that time when the United States was experiencing its resurgence of TB, just to emphasize that this is true, but my goodness, we have to accelerate accelerates that work, that pressure, and those initiatives. I think the TB community has done a great deal to change and accommodate to the needs of HIV, and yet, I think we still remain two communities divided by two common infections. I think the TB community still has to reach out more to the HIV community, but I also want to comment and to acknowledge that I think the TB community has changed more than the HIV community has, and that actually the balance, more effort needs to come from the HIV side. From the HIV perspective, we have to remember that in high-burden countries and high-burden settings, TB interventions are actually going to have to be delivered through HIV services. And TB needs to be placed at the very center of AIDS care in high-burden developing countries. That requires effort from the HIV community, but it's also going to require understanding and support and some generosity from the TB community, including perhaps letting go sometimes of a little bit of the control. Clearly, one of the most significant historical events in AIDS has been the introduction and of antiretroviral treatment and its scale-up, which is a double-edged sword for TB, because on the one hand, it can increase life in TB patients. It's probably, I often say that the introduction of ARVs may be as important for tuberculosis in high HIV settings as the introduction of anti-tuberculous drugs themselves in terms of saving patients' lives. It can reduce the incidence of TB by restoring immunity, but it also paradoxically can increase complexity and vulnerability by keeping HIV-infected patients alive, obviously a good thing, but alive with continued vulnerability to tuberculosis. So it's certainly our lives have become much, much more complex. We also need your help to deal with stigma and discrimination, because I think the TB community has many, many years of experience with a stigmatizing disease, but somehow gets on and deals with it. And I think we on the HIV side can learn from that. And I think we need your help as we deal with a very important issue, that of scaling up HIV testing, provider-initiated HIV testing and counseling in healthcare settings. And the TB community has a very important role to play. In this, the 3x5 era, I think some things have changed fundamentally. And obviously one thing that's changed also is that access to drugs for multi-drug resistant and XDR TB is something we just have to, in the same way that we did with ARVs, we're just going to have to say this is a right. This is something that has to be achievable everywhere. So finally, to finish my quick comments, just a few thoughts on the lessons of XDR, the implications of XDR for the HIV community and for HIV/AIDS, the struggle against HIV/AIDS. Firstly, I think one of the really worrying things is that what brought this to attention in South Africa was firstly HIV, that all of the patients heavily affected and with high mortality were HIV infected. The high mortality drew attention to it, but also the fact that it was South Africa that had the ability to do drug resistance testing. If this had happened somewhere else, we might never have known. I think because the development of drug resistance in XDR is really a phenomenon of Mendelian evolution, and second-line therapy is hardly used anywhere else in Africa, what the true extent of this problem may not be that widespread in Africa, but what I think is possibly widespread or will become so is MDR, with XDR then just the sort of tip of the iceberg, MDR, because those drugs are used elsewhere and patients will live longer as ARVs are scaled up. So as we have these discussions on XDR, I think we need to be prepared for a much, much broader need and attention to be paid to the problem of MDR TB, of which XDR, after all, is just an extension. It brings into issue the same, as did the whole 3x5 program, the whole issue of health systems and human resources. Health systems meaning the whole gamut, human resources, infrastructure, lab capacity, procurement systems, supply chains, management, etc. And I think we're sort of drawing a line in the sand here saying
finally, we have to deal with the issue of labs. We cannot make progress on this issue of drug-resistant TB without labs. And it's the situation in Africa is actually amazingly dire. Outside of South Africa, in many, many countries in the public sector, it is not even possible to make a bacteriological diagnosis of Salmonella typhi, let alone sophisticated drug resistance testing for tuberculosis. So a reinvestment in the in laboratory capacity that has eroded in Africa in front of our eyes over the past 15 to 20 years is, I think, an absolute priority and should be a priority for donors. This whole issue obviously raises the problem of tuberculosis transmission in congregate settings, in hospitals, and we are congregating patients for ARV services in hospitals where infection control has been neglected over the years. And it will not be restricted, this problem of TB transmission to hospitals, but it goes on in prisons and other congregate settings as well. The issue of human resources, this was the subject of WHO's World Health Report in the last year. Obviously, it's tragic that in the South African experience there were healthcare workers who died. And providing a safe and a safe working environment is going to have to be a priority because we cannot tolerate the impression to emerge that caring for AIDS patients or caring for TB patients is dangerous and is something that people won't want to do. That is something we just cannot allow to emerge. Finally, is any of this new? Not really. What we're witnessing really is the events of New York City in the late 1980s and early 90s playing out in a southern African context. And it's, it just brings, it reinforces again the tragedies that can emerge when basic public health infrastructure is allowed to erode and when lessons of surveillance and infection control and so on are not taken care of. So thank you for the opportunity to speak from the HIV perspective, and I hope that these two communities, TB and HIV, will unite around this this extremely serious issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it. I need to acknowledge that in spite of our best laid out plans, we are on time, but have run out of time for questions, which I am mortified about personally. I know that there's another session in here at 2 p.m., but I'll be bold and allow a couple of questions as long as they're short and the answers are equally short. Members of the press, please refrain. Know that there will be a press conference in room 235 mezzanine, which is a 2.5 level here in the conference center. So if I can see a microphone or persons at the microphone with this glare, I can barely see.
Ken?
Yes, please.
Okay. Hi, Kevin Fenley, New Jersey, U.S. Let me try to make a weak attempt to represent a human resource that we've not heard from. And that is the clinician facing a patient with MDR or worse, XDR. I think this is a desperate situation, and on an individual basis, you know, the clinicians are going to have to tell these patients that, you know, if they have HIV, they're likely to die. If they don't, it'll be a protracted course with very toxic medicines. What I'd like to see a call for is for clinical trials on what's the optimal way to treat MDR-TB, because obviously XDR-TB has resulted from inadequate treatment of MDR-TB,
right,
just as MDR-TB is a result of inadequate treatment of drugs susceptible. So we not only need, you know, new tools, new drugs, but one thing that's been omitted is that surgical resection has improved outcomes in the U.S., and I think it should be considered for, you know, desperate situations in other areas. South Africa has a lot of talented people, and I'm sure something could be mobilized, but people will need to be trained. But as you know, in Denver, outcomes improved dramatically with surgical resection of cavities in selected patients.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I appreciate that comment. The last comment is going to come from Dr. Perlman from the Russian Federation.
My name is Perelman. I am from Moscow. and I want to say several words about
Several words, please.
Yes. Several words about the classification of resistance. In my opinion, the classification must be clear and short. Mm-hmm. No resistance. This is grade zero. MDR-TB. This is grade one. XDR-TB. This is grade two. And the resistance to all drugs, this is grade three. On the paper, this is very short and simple. After the diagnosis, we must write R0, R1, R2, or R3. This is my proposal. And the last, in the treatment of the MDR and XDR-TB, there are very important two old methods, tools. This is collapsotherapy and surgery. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Perlman. You have hereby been recruited to be part of the technical group revising definitions. Thank you all for being here.